From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, a Democrat from the Midwestern state of Michigan, and we're coming to you from her office on Capitol Hill. Congresswoman Slotkin represents Michigan's 8th congressional district. She is serving her first term in the House of Representatives after defeating two-term Republican incumbent Mike Bishop in the November 2018 midterm elections. Congresswoman Slotkin is a member of the House Armed Services and Homeland Security Committees. She serves on the subcommittees on intelligence and emerging threats and capabilities, readiness, intelligence and counterterrorism, as well as the subcommittee on cybersecurity, infrastructure protection, and innovation. Congresswoman Slotkin has spent her career in national service. Before her election, she worked as a CIA Middle East analyst. She spent 3 tours in Iraq, working alongside the U.S. military as a militia expert. Between tours in Iraq, Representative Slotkin held various defense and intelligence positions under President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama, including roles at the White House and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. In 2011, she served as Acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, where she oversaw policy on Russia, Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Congresswoman Slotkin about a range of domestic and national security issues facing the United States. Congresswoman Slotkin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We're delighted that you hosted us right here in your office.
Sure.
Congresswoman, you're one of the many Democrats who captured seats previously held by Republicans, and now Democrats are in the majority in the lower chamber of the Congress, the House of Representatives. What prompted you to run for office, especially with your focus on national security and counterterrorism?
Sure. So, you know, I'd always been in national security. I'd work for Democrats. I'd work for Republicans. Frankly, wasn't that political. My husband's an Army colonel. So between a CIA background and an Army background, we really weren't engaged in politics. But I think in 2016, the tenor and tone of politics just felt unbecoming of the country. And I started thinking about running. And it was a pretty daunting prospect because of things like money in politics and just have never done it before, had never thought about it before. But that changed in May of 2017. And it was really the issue of health care. And the vote to repeal protections for people with pre-existing conditions by the House of Representatives was a pretty in or out moment for me. My mom had died of ovarian cancer, and when she was diagnosed, she did not have health insurance. She had had a pre-existing condition, a pre-existing cancer, so she had always struggled with health care. So when I saw my opponent, my later opponent, on the White House lawn in May of 2017 celebrating the repeal of protections for people with pre-existing conditions, that was it. And I got in, and the rest is history, I guess.
So what I'm hearing is that the tenor and tone of the campaign in 2016, the importance of health care, all of that prompted you in your very deep and profound experience as a former CIA analyst and Pentagon official. And of course, let's remind our listeners that your district in Michigan voted for Trump in 2016. Mm-hmm. So, and you flipped the seat from Republican to Democratic.
Yeah.
So that's quite significant.
Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, I think Michigan is one of the few places in the country that, you know, votes the person over the party. We're a swing state, and we always have been. My dad was a Republican or is a Republican. My mom was a Democrat. We come from a sort of a mixed political background. So I was really proud to run as just a reasonable person, and I think that worked for people.
Talk about your district a bit, you know, the makeup of it, the economy.
Sure. Michigan's 8th district, the fight in 8th. We are in the middle of the state, sort of mid-Michigan is how I would call it. We go from the northern suburbs of Detroit all the way over to East Lansing and Lansing. Michigan State University is in the district. Oakland University, Lansing Community College. We have 2 big GM plants. You know, our capital is Lansing, Michigan, so the state government. We have a lot of teachers. We have a lot of robotics firms. So we're sort of a mixed community politically, economically. We've got a lot going on, but it's right in the middle of the state.
It sounds like the state, given its economy, is right in the throes of a lot of the discussions, whether around trade and tariffs,
yes.
And we're going to get into that.
Yep.
But first, I want to talk about your CIA background and your background in foreign affairs and national security. How does your work for the CIA, your many tours in Iraq and senior positions in the Department of Defense, inform your role as Congresswoman?
You know, I've thought about this quite a bit, and certainly becoming a new member of Congress, to me, the biggest crossover from my prior life and my current life is the ability to focus on the mission and put the mission above the politics, the noise, whatever's being said in the media. You know, I think it's easy now to be distracted because there's so much going on in a day on the news cycle. And coming from a Pentagon background and a CIA background, you don't have the luxury of being distracted. You have to focus on the mission. And that is something that I think I brought to Congress from my national security background.
What is your position, Congresswoman Slotkin, regarding America's role in the world, particularly as the Trump administration pursues a so-called America First strategy, which has resulted in the U.S. withdrawal from a number of multilateral treaties like the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran Nuclear Accord, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, this more go-it-alone posture?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of what he's done breaks with 75 years of tradition of the United States having a strong leadership role and attempting whenever possible to do things with allies. Almost immediately when the president came in, he sort of had this approach that was pushing and pointing our allies in the chest and cozying up to our adversaries. And I've worked, again, for Democrats and Republicans. We've had a pretty similar approach to foreign policy over the many, many decades. So it really got our attention, I guess, in the national security community, that's for sure. I would say, additionally, I believe that American leadership in the world is different than if we have Russian leadership or Chinese leadership. I think the United States has principles that go to our very founding, and that those principles have become principles people all over the world believe in. Democracy and freedom of expression. That, to me, is different than if we just sort of stand back, become isolationists, and let others like the Russians and the Chinese take our place. There is a difference between an American. We're not always right. We've had a ton of problems. We know that. But I still think we're better than a Chinese leadership role or a Russian leadership role in the world.
Well, that leads us to the U.S.-Iran tensions.
Yeah.
Look, you have enormous hands-on experience in this arena. You worked alongside the U.S. military during three tours in Iraq as a militia expert. What is your reaction, Congresswoman Slotkin, to reports that President Trump ordered an air attack on Iran and then called it off? And this was just after Iran this week shot down a U.S. surveillance drone, which they say was within Iranian airspace, which the United States says was in international airspace.
So I think launching a potential strike and then pulling it back kind of mid-operation is just indicative of a bigger problem that we don't have a clear strategy coming out of this administration. And if I don't understand what the strategy is and you and your viewers don't understand what the strategy is, how do the Iranians understand what the strategy is? When you have confusion like that, it opens up the opportunity for you to mistakenly sort of stumble into war, stumble into conflict. You may not want to do that, but suddenly you're there. And with tensions this high, the risk of that is very, very high. So hearing that from news reports that the president had a plan to potentially bomb certain sites, according to news reports, it could have cost the lives of 150 people. There was no one in the drone. A drone is an unmanned aerial vehicle. And so I just think we're getting into very, very dicey waters here that could really spiral into a big conflict.
Now let's step back a moment and take a look at the background. The Trump administration, with respect to Iran, is engaging in a so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. After the United States withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal last May, the U.S. has reimposed severe unilateral economic sanctions, which are crippling the Iranian economy, which may have caused it to lash out against these tankers in the Gulf of Oman recently. And so they are engaging in a counter campaign of maximum resistance, the latest example of which is, of course, this taking down of the U.S. drone. So coupled with that, the Trump administration has authorized also an extra deployment of more than 1,000 troops to the region in what some say looks like a gearing up for a potential conflict. So I need to get your view, Congresswoman Slotkin, with regard to the so-called AUMF, this authorization for the use of force. members of Congress are discussing this, whether or not the Trump administration has the authorization under the 2001 AUMF, if it has the authorization to strike Iran without congressional, you know, debate. I'd like to get your view on that, particularly as Secretary of State Pompeo is making a case that Iran has ties to al-Qaeda. And of course, if he can make that case, that could strengthen their argument that the AUMF does allow them to strike Iran without congressional debate. What is your view on two matters? Do you think Iran has ties to al-Qaeda? Do you believe that? And what is your view with respect to the AUMF?
So just to review the bidding, the authorization of military force that we passed in the wake of 9/11 allows us to go after al-Qaeda. And that's how we went into Afghanistan, and that's how we still conduct military activity against al-Qaeda affiliates like ISIS, right, in Iraq. And there is no way that back in 2001, first of all, 80% of Congress was not here in 2001. So there was no way that Congress intended to authorize military force against Iran. At that time, it was about al-Qaeda and Afghanistan. What concerns me is that you can see Secretary Pompeo in public at the hearing he did in front of the Senate in April. He would not rule out that that authorization of military force also allowed him to go to Iran. He just kept punting it and punting it and punting it. So that raises my attention, certainly. The secretary has also talked in public about the relationship between Iran and al-Qaeda, and a lot of the details are classified. But I would say for anyone who watched the wars in the Middle East for the last two decades, we should be extremely skeptical about any discussion between al-Qaeda and Iran. We should want to look at that intelligence in a deep and thoughtful way, because we know from the war in Iraq that in the run-up to that war, intelligence making a link between Iraq at that time, Saddam Hussein, and al-Qaeda was exaggerated, in some case fabricated. And we know now that those were not sound intelligence reports. So anybody should be hyper skeptical of any information between a positive link between al-Qaeda and Iran.
So let's get back to the tit for tat between U.S. and Iran in the Persian Gulf, in the Gulf of Oman. With respect to this unmanned aerial drone that Iran shot down, how do you think the United States should respond? Mm-hmm. And then on a larger question, how should the United States be trying to ratchet down tensions? Or do you think we should continue on this maximum pressure, whether economically or militarily?
So whenever the United States acts in the world, we have a whole toolkit. There are military tools, but hopefully most of those tools are the tools of last resort. We have diplomatic tools. We work through our development programs. We have lots of ways to engage with countries that we're unhappy with. And let me be clear. I mean, Iran is not a positive actor in the world. They are not. The terrorism that they have spread in Iraq, Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, it is bad news. That doesn't mean our only option is a large-scale war in the Middle East. Those are not our only options. We have a doctrine of proportional response in the United States. We don't believe that if someone attacks us, let's say in this situation, an unmanned drone, that the response should be nuclear war. That's not proportional. So I think whatever we do should be proportional. I'm not ruling out military action. I just don't think that killing scores of people because an unmanned drone was hit, a disputed location for that drone as well, is the right answer. I think that the most important thing is no matter what happens, we have to maintain diplomatic channels with the Iranians. We may not like them, we may not want to engage with them, but we must, because without it, you're going to have significant confusion. And I'm worried this administration has precious few actual direct contact links with the Iranian government.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest is Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, newly elected Democrat from the state of Michigan. Congresswoman Slotkin serves on the House of Representatives Armed Services and Homeland Security Committees. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Olajire Jones from Abuja, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now back to our special guest, Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, who represents the 8th District in Michigan. Congresswoman, I want to continue on our discussion about the Middle East. You served so many years in Iraq. How can the United States, in your view, more effectively combat Iran's destabilizing efforts to exploit sectarian tensions in the region, whether in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, or Yemen, and elsewhere? In other words, what policy should the U.S. adopt, particularly in Iraq, which by virtue of its large Shia population has a natural affinity with Iran, but whose militia groups and security forces are being infiltrated by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps forces?
I don't think this one is complicated. It is clear that when you have a strong government from the capital, run by decent people who reflect the citizenry of the country, then it's harder to exploit sectarian differences. When you have weak governments, and in a place like Yemen, you have non-existent basic government, it is exceptionally easy for an actor like Iran to come in, make alliances, and, you know, send some patronage the way of certain militias, make friends, and then be able to act through those militia groups. The stronger our states are in the Middle East, the harder it will be for them to exploit. That's the problem. We have weak state governments. Syria, obviously, Assad has been under fire for years now. Iraq, same thing. The stronger their centralized military can become, the more capable, the more that leadership in Baghdad can actually have a monopoly of force in the country and doesn't have to rely on some of these militias, the better. And so that's what American policy should be geared at. Now, that's difficult, but I don't think that the answer is we need to get into more wars. I think the answer is we need to figure out how to bring those conflicts to some sort of peaceful end and start rebuilding the states.
I'd like to ask you your position on arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Many of your lawmakers are very much opposed to selling additional arms to Saudi Arabia and even the UAE, given particularly Saudi Arabia's implication in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi dissident and journalist for the Washington Post, who was killed and dismembered in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. What is your position with regard to arms to Saudi Arabia? Do you think we should halt them?
I do. I think that the United States, we have to be a leader that leads from a place of rules and norms. And Saudi Arabia is an ally. They're a country we've had a long history with. We want to continue a positive relationship, but we can't just let even our friends get away with violating norms and rules in the international community. They have done that. They have done that with Khashoggi, but wow, they've also done that with the targeting in Yemen, the consistent targeting of civilians in Yemen. So for me, we have to act in a principled way. And we gave the Saudis ample opportunity to correct what they were doing in Yemen, to stop targeting civilians, to account for what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. And they haven't lived up to it. This administration is putting, from what I can tell, zero pressure on them. So Congress, I think, has the responsibility to weigh in and say we don't approve. And I do not.
Congresswoman, I'd like to turn now to another issue which is dear to your heart, and that's campaign finance reform.
Yeah.
You're a co-sponsor of H.R. 1.
Yeah.
What is called the For the People Act. It's described as a once-in-a-generation reform bill that seeks to restore legitimacy to our democracy. Yeah. What's the purpose of the bill, in your view? Why is it so important?
So it is a massive reform bill. I think it's over 500 pages. But the key themes for me and what I think are really important are, number one, a bunch of election security and voter access provisions. So just enhancing, strengthening, defending our democracy. Number two, campaign finance reform. The big one here is disclosure. There is just so much money sloshing around our political system, and so much of it is anonymous. We don't know who's donating to what organization. And I think that if you're going to donate and try to influence politics, you should put your name, your address, and your occupation down for the record. Same way someone who donates $15 to me has to do. And then for me in particular, there's a number of pieces that speak to protecting our political process. So a bill that I've sponsored that came out of H.R. 1 is the Paid Ads Act. So I don't believe foreigners should be able to buy political ads in our system that are for or against a candidate. The Russians, the Iranians, the Chinese, anyone.
Well, speaking of that, I'd like to get your takeaway from the Mueller report. So Robert Mueller, former special counsel who looked into Russia's interference in the 2016 election and any potential ties with the Trump campaign, particularly as regards Russia's malign role in the 2016 U.S. elections via cyber attacks mm-hmm. and the massive disinformation campaign on social media, yeah. which relates to your view on the ads, as well, of course, as its interference in European elections to boost fortunes of far-right and nationalist parties. What's your big takeaway from that report with respect to Russia?
Let's just set the table by saying that in any other time, under a Democrat or Republican president, even before the Mueller report came out, all 17 of the U.S. intelligence agencies came out and said, we believe Russia attempted to meddle in our elections, publicly. In any other presidency, we would have a blue ribbon panel with the greatest minds of a generation from national security and from Silicon Valley worlds coming together with a budget to write a report on how to protect our democracy, because it's that fundamental. Obviously, that hasn't happened. The Mueller report comes out. It reinforces, again, just the full-on attack by the Russians in the form of information warfare that's adapted from Eastern Europe and brought to the United States. So I read the Mueller report, and there is obviously a ton of work going on to try and understand the administration's role and what they did and did not do with the Russians. But there's a whole half of the report that no one is doing, you know, enough talking about, which is on information warfare and how we protect ourselves. There's a group of us looking at this right now. We're members of Congress with a security background or with a law background, and we're all trying to create a suite of legislation that protects ourselves in 2020. Because we can talk about the president's role all we want, and we should, but we're not doing anything to protect ourselves in 2020. So that's where I've been putting my attention, because that's my background. My expertise helps me in that process.
That leads me to my next question. Yeah. Just as you said previously, all U.S. intelligence agencies confirmed that Russia interfered in our 2016 elections, and they are warning that Russia is already actively working to interfere in the 2020 elections. So what are your views specifically with regard to how we should combat this, particularly noting that the GOP-controlled Senate and Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in particular, appears to be attempting to block important election security legislation? And to what extent has Michigan, your state, been a target of disinformation campaigns by Moscow?
Well, we know that Michigan was disproportionately affected, and you should see some of these ads. I mean, they're horrible. You know, these Russian-affiliated actors created fake groups, fake organizations for Muslim Americans, African Americans, spewing out hatred and dissent, divisiveness, trying to split us apart, start a race war. They created fake groups and made fake protests. They targeted through social media sort of the Facebook pages of so many people in Michigan. The number three at Facebook said he thinks for the cost of about $100,000, these Russian organizations got to about 129 million eyeballs in the United States. That's an amazing return on their investment. And I think it shouldn't be a political issue, right? It shouldn't be a Democrat or Republican thing. Foreigners should not be buying ads for or against a candidate in our political process. If you're a bot and not a human being and you're spreading some of this hatred, you should have to label yourself. And you should have to disclose where money is coming from. Because if you don't know, the donor of $15 million to some political organization doesn't have to disclose themselves. Well, they could be some guy from Kansas. They could also be a Russian actor. So,
yeah, but the problem is the House can pass all the legislation
yes.
at once. But if the Senate blocks the legislation, do you think the Senate, given Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's views that he's blocking this kind of legislation? I mean, can you get this done? So is he afraid of Trump vetoing the legislation?
You know, I can't speak to what he believes. He is shirking his responsibilities. And one of the things that we've tried to do with legislation that I've already presented and that I will present in the next couple of weeks is make it bipartisan, both in the House and in the Senate. I disagree with people like Senator Graham all the time. But on the issue of protecting ourselves, there's some good pieces of legislation that he's willing to co-sponsor. I will do whatever I need to do to help make this as likely as possible to pass through. But Mitch McConnell should be embarrassed for his unwillingness to take up things like election security, protecting our democracy. And history is not going to look kindly on him for shirking those responsibilities.
Well, let's get back to Russia's nefarious activities, not just in the United States, but around the world. It's been engaging in disinformation campaigns for a long time in the Baltic states and eastern Ukraine. Let's not forget they illegally annexed Crimea in 2014. They continue to destabilize the Middle East by virtue of their backing of the butcher Bashar al-Assad in Syria, etc. Are you concerned, though, about Mr. Trump's consistent defense of Vladimir Putin and, for example, desire to speak to him one-on-one without aides, and Mr. Trump's spurning of the U.S. intelligence community's assessment of Moscow and its malign role in the 2016 election, something that he has actually yet to publicly acknowledge?
Yeah. Everyone that I know, Democrat, Republican, or Independent, cannot understand why the president feels such a cozy relationship with Vladimir Putin. And the press conference that they did together in Helsinki last summer was, for me, you know, I was home in Michigan in my district, and people across the political spectrum could not stand to see the president of the United States kowtowing to the president of Russia. So of course I'm concerned about it. And as someone who's a former CIA officer, it is deeply, deeply offensive that he preferenced Vladimir Putin over the intelligence community. That is something that, just as a commander in chief, it's like being the coach of a football team and just slamming one of your players. It just doesn't make any sense. We are all on the same team, and he should be listening to his Department of Justice, his intelligence community, his Pentagon.
One more national security issue. Well, all of these are national security issues. The Afghan war, the longest war the United States has been engaged in. What's your position with respect to winding down this conflict? Are you in favor of the talks with the Taliban? Are you skeptical? What's your view of how we can wind this down?
Yeah, so I do believe we need to wind it down. I mean, this is, I think, we have to acknowledge the role and relationship between the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and now the prospect of another war with Iran. Every American should be learning the lessons of the past two decades that it's a lot easier to get into these wars than it is to get out. So, yes, we need to be wrapping up what we're doing in Afghanistan. It will never be perfect. We have to find a stable way for Afghanistan to continue to exist as a nation without harboring terrorists, but that we don't spend our blood and treasure to make it perfect. So I support having talks to end that conflict. Now, talks directly with the Taliban without the central Afghan government. You know, I always learned, you know, don't talk about them without them. So I think it's pretty difficult to come to a healthy conclusion without the Afghan government being a part of it. So I am hopeful that Ambassador Khalilzad will start to fold them in sooner rather than later. But I do think we need to be having conversations to figure out how we bring this to a just and rightful end.
I want to close by talking about trade and tariffs, because it probably affects your district.
Yes.
Specifically. What is your view, Congresswoman Slotkin, on the use of tariffs, not only to coerce allies like India and the EU and Canada, but also as a tool to change, for example, China's egregious unfair trading practices? You know, some critics say that there are more effective tools to influence China's trade practices.
Yeah, so I don't think anyone, certainly in my district, feels that China is playing fairly in the international system. China is cheating. China is not being a good international actor when it comes to the issues of trade and currency and intellectual property. But we can't have the cure for that problem be worse than the disease. And I think some of the tariffs that have been imposed, first of all, they create immense instability, particularly for industries in Michigan. And my business owners will tell me, I'm just trying to be able to have a predictable plan for the next year. And with these tariffs and the way the administration is sort of cavalier about threatening them, it is hard for a business owner to have that stability so they can plan. Separate from China, I just can't support the use of some very, very sort of obscure authorities like declaring national security emergencies when it comes to our allies. When it comes to Canada, I'm going to declare, you know, trade coming from Canada as a national security threat. That's the authority they're using in order to slap some of these tariffs on. I believe in rules and standards. I believe we have to be a country that upholds them. So the way they went about this, I just deeply alienates our allies. And to me, that's always a bad thing, especially when you've got adversaries in the world. So we know that in Michigan, for instance, the supply chain to making cars, we have a ton of industry focused on that, is disproportionately affected. Our farmers, I mean, I live on a soybean farm. We are disproportionately affected by the tariffs and the trade wars that are going on right now.
Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin is a freshman Democrat from the state of Michigan. Congresswoman Slotkin, thanks so much for your time and fabulous insights on so many critical issues.
Thanks very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.